Hey everyone, Joey here. A couple of weeks ago, we released an episode called Special Episode, Roundtable on Israel-Palestine, with Daniel Kurd, Orly Noy, and Yair Wallach. It has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of feedback, which I'm genuinely very, very grateful for. It is by far the most listened to episode of the Fire These Times so far. And that led the team and I to explore ways forward. We want to do more deep dives into Israel-Palestine. Obviously, right now, Israel-Palestine is in the news, but we want to go beyond that. We want to kind of do the episodes that maybe all the listeners of the Fire These Times are more familiar with, namely like evergreen episodes. Episodes that are relevant today, but hopefully will remain relevant in like a year, two, five, 10, and so on. So we're preparing those. We have a number of them coming up. I won't say too much on them yet. What I will say is that they roughly follow the same format as a special episode. So in other words, a roundtable, a panel in which there are a number of hosts as well as a number of guests, with some hosts speaking more than others and some guests be also speaking more than others. So as I said, there's a number of them coming up. But in the meantime, we decided to release an episode that I recorded in 2021, back when this project was still sort of a one geek team. And that episode was entitled, and still is entitled, Understanding Hamas Anti-Authoritarian Perspectives, with the guest being Tariq Bakouni. Tariq is, I would argue, one of the world's foremost experts on Hamas. He's written a book on Hamas called Hamas Contained, which I highly recommend. He's done it recently. Post October 7th, 2023, after Hamas's massacre, Tariq was interviewed in a number of publications and outlets. And what I wanted to do here is repost this old episode from 2021 for a couple of reasons. One, the vast majority of the information that Tariq provides here is not time sensitive, in the sense that these are contextual information about Hamas, where it comes from, how did they grow, why are they powerful, and so on and so forth, in the context of the Palestinian story. The second thing is that in 2021, when I was recording this, I think at some point, even in this episode, if I'm not mistaken, I mentioned something along the lines of, whenever we talk about Israel-Palestine, it's almost always the same story, in the sense that, for the most part, Israel-Palestine is not in the news. And then when it is in the news, it's usually because something really horrible has happened. There might be some attacks in the West Bank, although notably the attacks by Palestinians are the ones that make it to the news, but attacks, daily attacks by settler extremists are very rarely in the news. And usually this is followed by like a wide-scale Israeli response. Now, this has taken a different scale since October 7th, as I assume most listeners know by now. After Hamas's massacre on that date, Israel has effectively decided to engage in what I can only describe as a genocidal campaign against the entirety of the Palestinian people. This is a very clear campaign of collective punishment, of ethnic cleansing, and as I said, of genocide. But this is not what this episode is about. This is what some future episodes might be about. But this episode is, in some sense, to ground us a bit in the reality of what Gaza was before October 7th, in many ways still is after October 7th. But it's sort of a way of pushing back against the narrative of that things are happening, you know, without a context. The things just happen because one group just decided one day to lose their minds and to commit a massacre. Now, while I hope this goes without saying that this podcast is firmly anti-authoritarian, the team is firmly anti-authoritarian, these are our politics, we are therefore extremely anti-Hamas, we refuse to simplify the narrative as being just a bunch of extremists who just did a bunch of stuff because they hate people and that's that. That is not an objective assessment. This is a political party, an extremist political party, a very authoritarian political party, yes, but it exists in a certain context. And that context has to be understood if we want to understand how we got where we are. So that's it. I'm going to stop at that. Thank you for listening. The last thing I will say is, if you appreciate this episode as well as other episodes of the Fire These Times, please consider doing a couple of things that can really help this podcast. The first and best way to help the Fire These Times is to support us on Patreon. And all you have to do is to go on patreon.com/firethesetimes and support us on it with a monthly or yearly donation, whatever amount you're able to donate. Second thing is, please leave your review wherever you listen to podcasts. This can be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, other podcast apps. and tell your friends about us, tag us on social media, share stuff, you know, that sort of thing. It's the only way to sort of stay afloat with the monstrosity that are modern algorithms of big social media giants that I am not a big fan of. But this is what it is for now, and this is just a small podcast. I am not confident that we're able to take them on, at least not yet. Anyway, thank you for listening, everyone.
My name is Tareh Bahouni. I'm a Palestinian currently living in Ramallah, between Ramallah and London. And my book, Hamas Contained, The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance, came out in 2018, which was published by Stanford University Press. I've spent a few years thinking and writing on Gaza, on Hamas, and more broadly on the Palestinian struggle for liberation.
Thanks a lot for having this conversation with me. You know, throughout this episode, I'll be referring to a really good interview that you had with 972 Mag's Amjad Iraei, which was done last month. So the goal of this episode really is to have a self-contained episode about Hamas, meaning that people listening to this episode don't have to know much in order to follow our conversation. Usually, I don't really like doing episodes on specific political parties, but you know, Hamas is just part of the Palestinian story. It's just a reality. But at the same time, it's often talked about without much nuance or understanding, especially in the West, but not just in the West. Personally, you know, I've been interviewed on Palestine a number of times, and whenever I'm asked about Hamas, there's always a sense that like the representation of Hamas or like the image of Hamas precedes the question, right? Like more than so, the question isn't really about the question, if you see what I mean. It's more about what they think about Hamas, if that makes sense. So just before we get in, I would just briefly say that I've had a couple of episodes, episode 52 with Francesco Saverio Leopardi, entitled The Palestinian Left and Its Decline, focusing on the 80s up until roughly the early 2000s, focused on the PFLP, the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and more recently, another episode, which is 66, with Daniel Kurd, entitled Legacies of Authoritarianism in Palestine, which de facto focus on the Palestinian Authority. I just wanted to say that kind of this upfront, you know, to emphasize that future episodes will be about exploring ways forward for Palestinian activism. But the reality of the matter now is that both Hamas and the PA, especially recently when it comes to the PA, are involved in repressing protesters and activists. So I would argue, you know, that understanding these two parties is key to challenging them and moving beyond them. All that said and done, I'll shut up now. You know, the interview that you've had with 972 Mag was titled Hamas Breaks Out of Its Gaza Cage, right? I think it would be good to just start from that, really. Like, from the most recent events, I don't really like calling them events, but here we are, before broadening the conversation to contextualize and understand the movement and the party. My first question to you is, like, what was Hamas's role in what's been happening in the past few months? Why did it make those decisions in your view? And how would you interpret those decisions in terms of whether they were different from previous policies and so on?
So thank you, Joey, for having me on this. I mean, I think the first thing I want to say is just to go to something that you said when you were introducing this episode and saying that you wanted something that's self-contained on Hamas, and your impulse is not necessarily to differentiate specific political parties and focus on them. And I just want to recognize this tension when it comes to the study of Hamas, because it's one that I grapple with all the time. Hamas is often portrayed as a movement that exists outside of the question of Palestine, that it's somehow an exceptional case outside of Palestine, and that if we were able to wish Hamas away or address Hamas in a different way, if only Hamas was brought to heel in a certain way, then the question of Palestine will be resolved. And I think this is something that needs to be challenged head on. Hamas is part and parcel of the Palestinian struggle for liberation, and one cannot be differentiated from the other. The Palestinian struggle for liberation is a movement that is heterogeneous and diverse in every way. And Hamas is just one facet of that struggle, and trying to exceptionalize it by placing it in a self-contained let's say, podcast like this, or to try to present it as something that's external to the Palestinian struggle is very problematic. At the same time, I appreciate the effort to try to understand Hamas on its own terms, because it is a complex movement and because there is a lot of effort to try to separate it and exceptionalize it. So there is a lot of value in this kind of podcast and in this kind of engagement with Hamas, as long as we contextualize it within this broader Palestinian struggle for liberation. And I think that the events of the past 2 months, I also don't like calling them events. So let's call them what they need to be called, the Palestinian uprising against continued settler colonialism in East Jerusalem, which ended up triggering a much broader Palestinian movement. Some people are calling it the Unity Intifada. Is actually a very good example to showcase how Hamas is part and parcel of the broader Palestinian movement. The decision by Hamas's leadership in May to fire rockets at Israel in order to protect Palestinians who were being and continue to be forcibly expelled from Sheikh Jarrah signaled a transformative decision for the movement, in the sense that it was willing to use significant power and to dip into its military arsenal in order to both come to the rescue and to protect Palestinians in Jerusalem who are suffering the brunt of Israeli occupation, but also to change the balance of power on the ground. And what I mean by that is to say that for the past few years, certainly since Hamas has been contained in the Gaza Strip, by the blockade that is imposed by Israel and co-administered by Egypt, Hamas has mostly limited the use of its firepower and its military arsenal to try to lift the siege of Gaza. So to try to lift the blockade, to try to force Israeli authorities to ease access, to allow for more entry of goods into and out of the Gaza Strip, and to generally lift what is a stifling blockade that enforces a form of collective punishment on 2 million Palestinians. What we saw in May was a decision by Hamas to shift this equation, to say actually that that it is a party that is willing to use its military power not only to negotiate restrictions and the nature of the blockade, but actually to mobilize in defense of Palestinians writ large, in this case being Jerusalem. And we can talk about the implications of what that means. Now, often it's been said that this was the first time that Hamas had fired rockets into Jerusalem. That's not the case. There were rockets in the past, including in 2012, that fell from Hamas towards Jerusalem, and not necessarily of the scale of these rockets that we saw in May. But the difference in this moment in time is that it was a strategic decision taken by the movement to position itself as a protector of the Palestinian people writ large. And I think that's a very important moment, which is why, as you referenced, the interview was titled Hamas Breaks Out of Its Cage in Gaza.
Right. Wait, so a lot there. And thanks a lot, I mean, even for starting this. You know, I was very worried that there's going to be the risk of just essentializing a party that is so heavily mediatized, right? Like, there's just the image of Hamas, as I said, like, precedes any kind of conversation about Hamas, any kind of, like, rational conversation about them, which is why I really appreciate what you said. And, you know, one of the shortcomings of an audio podcast is that you don't see me nodding along all the time. So that's one thing.
It's good to know.
No, I definitely do agree. It is like, I'm, you know, it's kind of an open question for me. So I really appreciate what you were saying. Even as we're talking now, like I always struggle to talk about a specific party for the simple reason that, or a movement, or both, for the simple reason that there are always these wider structures and wider, you know, factors, you know, just a broader story, right? And indeed, even the two other episodes that I did weren't supposed to be really about either the PFLP in the first case or the PA in the second case. It just so happened that we ended up just focusing on that. So maybe that's kind of what we'll do here. As you said, like, it seems to have made Hamas seems to have made the calculation recently that nothing other than inflicting some kind of cost on the Israeli state would garner some kind of attention, with the ultimate goal, at least part of the ultimate goal, to lift the siege of Gaza. I, for me, from my standpoint, this seems objectively true as well, as nothing else seems to have worked. I mean, I remember very well the March of Return, as it was called some years ago, where, like, the Israeli soldiers were just sniping off Palestinian civilians, and that definitely did not lead to any kind of emergency sessions, right, at the UN or whatever. So I guess if it's okay with you, and, you know, this might also be problematic, I don't know, feel free to kind of, you know, answer back as well. Can you give us some overview of the quote-unquote peaceful tactics used by Palestinians in recent whatever, whenever we want to start, to resist Israel, with a focus on Gaza, because I know the West Bank, you know, it's this entire thing as well. But, you know, even as I say this, I feel like separating Gaza and the West Bank is also very problematic. So just feel free to answer however you want. Just to give us some kind of idea of why there was this recent development, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, I think it's best to maybe start by talking about Hamas specifically. But then, as always, I want to bring it back to the broader Palestinian story. Hamas has been talking about different forms of struggle, whether it's armed resistance or popular resistance or economic resistance, since its creation. The movement has explored and experimented with different forms of resistance to the Israeli occupation, predominantly and most controversially, obviously, the use of suicide bombing in the 90s and early 2000s. Now, the movement has not been committed exclusively to armed resistance. And internally within the movement, there are a lot of divisions around which tactics to be used. Khalid Mish'al, before he departed from his position as the head of the movement, very openly and on an international platform, talked about the movement's willingness to engage in popular resistance. So that is to engage in forms of resistance that are not committed to the use of military force, specifically in this case, after Hamas's blockade in the Gaza Strip, the use of rocket fire. Now, none of the overtures that Hamas's leadership put out in terms of engaging with popular resistance have softened the international approach towards Hamas and allowed for the opening of diplomatic channels with the movement. They were always seen as either tricks by the movement or not necessarily policies that the movement would be able to push through. The Great March of Return, which you referenced, was the first real concerted effort by Hamas's leadership to support a peaceful, politically plural, largely popular, so grassroots-led movement to emerge in the Gaza Strip. Often, you know, before the first protesters had even reached the fence that separates the Gaza Strip from Israel, Israeli media was already calling this a Hamas protest and already calling a sort of a protest of terror because Hamas had to give the permission and the okay for this protest to happen. Now, there's no denying the fact that as the governing authority in Gaza, Hamas did indeed have to support this protest, and it provided much of the infrastructure for the protests, including the transfer of protesters by buses to the fence area. But that does not deny the fact that the protest was by and large a popular-led protest in every way, in terms of the congregation, in terms of the forms of mobilization, in terms of the ambiance of the protest itself, which included dancing and songs and nationalistic mobilization. Now, the Israeli response to the protest from day one was to use live fire against peaceful protesters, as you said, in ways that sniped off not only civilians, but medics and journalists and other targets that are protected under international laws. Of course, civilians are, but in the form of Israeli attacks against these largely peaceful protests were so egregious that we have now multiple examples of journalists and healthcare professionals and medics being sniped off. Now, the protests, to contextualize this to your listeners, is one of the longest, most sustained forms of popular mobilization in Palestinian history. And the result of those protests was almost silence on the international stage. The International Criminal Court put forward an investigation in order to try to see and understand whether these protests were violent or not, and whether Israeli claims of self-defense were valid or not. And the investigation, which is public, which can be viewed, says that Israeli responses to the protests may have amounted to war crimes, and that there was no proportionate reason that would allow Israel to use the force that it used. Now, that was a very key moment, not just for Hamas's leadership, but also for Palestinians, who often Palestinians who are talking about a rights-based struggle or about shifting to popular mobilization in a single state, often using the example of Black Lives Matter or the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, thinking that if there is significant popular mobilization on the ground, there would be enough popular pressure on Israel in order to limit its use of force against Palestinians and allow for changes in Israeli policies and Israeli violence against Palestinians. But the Great March of Return absolutely shows that not to be the case. There was comfort in the international stage with Israeli use of force against civilian protesters. The only shift that began to happen was when Hamas entered the fray. And here, Hamas entered the fray not in the form of rocket fire and missiles. It did eventually, but at the beginning, it entered the fray through tactics that disturb Israel, even if they do not cause civilian deaths or actual violence in Israel. So things like the incendiary balloons and the flammable kites and the what they call the nightly disturbances, which is the use of very loud speakers or the use of very loud noises through loudspeakers close to the fence area to keep residential areas on the other side of the fence awake at night. That's when the negotiations started happening. The lesson out of this is clear. Unless the average Israeli citizen begins to feel disturbed by Palestinian resistance, nothing will change, either in terms of Israeli readiness to engage to end this resistance, or in terms of the international community's response to the reality and the violence on the ground. So I just want to take this moment, this snapshot that I just drew from Gaza to Jerusalem in May. We had iftar sit-ins, we had prayer sit-ins, we had popular mobilization of Palestinians in Jerusalem against Sheikh Jarrah. By the time the first rocket from the Gaza Strip fell on Jerusalem, more than 500 Palestinians had been injured by Israeli forces. But the first time the international community talks about self-defense is when that rocket fell on Israel. So the lesson is that not only that Palestinians do not have the right to self-defense, or that the international community is okay with Israeli violence against Palestinians, but that it's only when there is violence against Israel that channels for negotiations and mobilization on the international community for change comments. Now, the lessons here are clear. And Hamas, since then, has consistently spoken about the need, or the readiness, I should say, for popular mobilization. But that's not just a Hamas conversation. That's also a Palestinian conversation about what tactics can be used to end the Israeli occupation. What is the use of armed struggle, if any? And I should note here that the international law allows for the use of armed struggle in accordance with international law by anti-colonial movements. Hamas's use of armed struggle through indiscriminate violence is not in accordance with international law because it's indiscriminate and it targets civilians. But the use of armed struggle as a tactic is one that Palestinians think about. And the other, of course, is popular mobilization, which so far has not been as effective as armed struggle in terms of increasing pressure on Israel. And the third form of mobilization, of course, maybe the most well-known, is BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, which is also met by repression, both by Israel and by members of the international community that are increasingly positioning this as a form of anti-Semitism. The lesson being that there can be no struggle that is sufficiently disruptive of the Israeli occupation that is not seen as problematic by an international community that's focused on managing the status quo, not providing Palestinian rights.
All right, thanks for that. And you anticipated sort of like the next two questions. I'll start with the first one. The matter of, you know, elections, right? Like whenever I've spoken to especially non-Palestinians when it comes to like the relationship between Hamas and Fatah, I've noticed that the topic of elections often comes up, you know, ask a very simple question, like, why don't they just hold elections? But then, as you mentioned now, as many people have also mentioned, Hamas actually won the last election in 2006, and the Palestinian government was sanctioned as a result by the, again, same so-called international community. Fatah was backed in an effort to isolate Hamas, and when that didn't really work, you know, as far as I can understand it, the resulting status quo was basically extended indefinitely. And now we're sort of seeing a different phase in recent weeks, if not months. Now, like even as of now, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the EU still officially calls for just elections to happen, even though they themselves, and I'm just focusing on the EU because I know it most, but you know, focus on other actors as well if you want, even though they have no intentions of dealing with Hamas if Hamas wins again. So what is exactly the point of such elections?
This is a very good question. The first thing I would say is that there's an untenable hypocrisy in the European and even the American position on Palestinian elections, which is to say that they support elections and they want Palestinians to have representative leadership. At the same time, they say that there is no willingness to engage with Hamas if Hamas enters power, which basically means that there can only be respect for elections if they produce the political choice that is seen to be favored by the European Union, European member states, and by the US. Other than that, forms of marginalization of boycott, so a repeat of the 2006 experience, is likely to happen. Now, this hypocrisy rests in the so-called quartet conditions. There are three conditions that the international community has put forward for engagement with Hamas. The first is to recognize Israel. The second is to recognize past agreements that are signed between the PLO and Israel. And the third is to renounce violence. Now, none of these conditions are equally applied to the state of Israel, which has not recognized the state of Palestine, does not renounce violence, and as we talked about, uses disproportionate violence against Palestinians, and does not respect past agreements signed with the PLO. But nonetheless, these three conditions are placed specifically for engagement with Hamas. When Hamas won the last elections in 2006, not only was there a refusal to recognize Hamas's election victory, there was a concerted diplomatic, political, and military push by the administration of George W. Bush to strengthen Fatah internally and politically, enable Fatah to marginalize Hamas and precipitate a coup in which Hamas would be kicked out of government and Fatah would take over. That's the backdrop, that's the context that ultimately resulted in Hamas's takeover of the Gaza Strip in 2007. So the civil war that we saw between Hamas and Fatah, it's more accurate to call it a factional war between these two factions in 2007, was precipitated by a West that is refusing to deal with democratic elections as Palestinians participated in. Now, we are still stuck in a moment where there is now a repeat of a call to international to elections without that inability to engage with or willingness to engage with Hamas having been resolved. Now, that's sort of the surface explanation of all of this. But I want to dig in one step deeper, which is to say, I don't necessarily condone the idea of elections as it's currently being understood. When you're referring to people telling you, you know, Hamas and Fatah need to engage in elections in order to have a more representative leadership, what those policymakers are telling you is that there needs to be an end to the institutional division between Hamas and Fatah and a resumption of the PA, so that the PA can come back into the Gaza Strip and take over control of the Gaza Strip. Now, that's all well and good. I think the end of the division is something that most Palestinians would aspire to. But there are two problems that come out of that, that come out of that formulation. The first is that those elections are not Palestinian elections. Those elections are Oslo elections. They are elections for the Palestinians in the occupied territories, so the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, to elect a legitimate leadership within the governing authority. So we're not talking about the leadership that is representing Palestinians in negotiations or that is shaping the future of the Palestinian liberation struggle. We're talking about the leadership that is managing Palestinian affairs under occupation. That is not the kind of leadership or the kind of elections that we need to be thinking about or engaged in when we're talking about the Palestinian struggle for liberation. Those elections are the elections that have to happen on the level of the PLO, and those are the elections that Hamas is aspiring to get into, even in this latest round, the elections that were just postponed in May, just before the uprising in Jerusalem. So just to bear in mind that when the international community is talking about elections, it's actually talking about ending an institutional division and allowing a governing authority that's functioning under occupation to become a more effective and a more legitimate government. It's not necessarily reflecting on elections that could allow for a more representative Palestinian leadership to emerge. The second thing that I would say is that there's a fundamental misunderstanding about the blockade of the Gaza Strip and its separation from the West Bank. There's this idea that if there can be a united Palestinian authority and Hamas can be somehow engaged in democratic elections, whether it wins or not, that the blockade is going to be lifted. And that's entirely untrue. The blockade was put in place before Hamas was even established as a party. In different ways and in different forms, we've had a blockade on the Gaza Strip since the occupation began in 67. Israel's separation of the Gaza Strip has nothing to do with Hamas. It has everything to do with the fact that there are 2 million Palestinians in Gaza, the majority of whom are refugees, seeking the right of return to homes now in Israel. And the demographic balance means that the Gaza Strip, for various reasons, which we can talk about, needs to be separated geographically and also institutionally. But this idea that elections are somehow going to herald a form of unity is one that's fantastical. It's not rooted in any kind of historical understanding of what the Gaza Strip is and why successive Israeli governments are bent on separating it.
Thanks a lot for that. And actually, like, the next question is basically an extension of your own thoughts. If you want to just continue in expanding, like, how Israel is actually dealing with Hamas. I mean, you know, I can just say divide and conquer as one, you know, easy go-to term, but how would you explain it to people who may not understand how old the blockade is, right? How old this obsession or this policy with separating Gaza from the West Bank has been?
Hamas is a fundamental part of the Israeli effort to maintain the Gaza Strip as an entity, as a piece of land that is separate from the rest of the Palestinians, but that is not necessarily entirely unmanageable, that it becomes a catastrophic strip of land. So just to elaborate on what that means, Hamas is currently a government in the Gaza Strip, and its management of the affairs of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza is one that successive Israeli governments, certainly governments under Netanyahu in his long tenure in Israel, have been very, very actively supporting. Hamas provides Israel with a fig leaf that for the West and for the international community, it allows Israel to portray the Gaza Strip as a strip of land or a haven, a terrorist haven that is run by a terrorist organization, and therefore to justify the blockade to an international community that is willing to accept the collective punishment of 2 million Palestinians in favor of fighting terrorism. So it provides that kind of external or Western-facing rhetoric, while internally for Israel, it allows the governments or the state of Israel to outsource the management of the Gaza Strip, what is essentially a large, very congested, very populated refugee camp, to a governing authority, in this case Hamas, and to external actors, including Qatar and the European Union and other actors, which provide and fund all the humanitarian relief in the Gaza Strip. So essentially, Hamas allows Israel to sustain a reality of blockade and a reality of separation that might otherwise be condemned more vocally if Hamas wasn't there. And this use of Hamas for Israel is one that's been evident over the course of the past 14 years of the blockade. We see Israel doing two things towards Hamas. First, making sure that the movement does not develop into the kind of military power that Hezbollah is, for example, by trying to maintain restrictions on the movement's, obviously, access to funds and military power, but also by deterrence. So by every few years, the Israeli government does what is called mowing the lawn, which is to go in and destroy key Hamas infrastructure and in the past assassinate Hamas personnel and leaders in order to make sure to limit the movement's ability to gain power. And so that's sort of the first thing that it does. But in doing so, completely avoiding destroying Hamas, because for Israel, there needs to be a functioning government in the Gaza Strip that, as I said, is governing and taking care of the administrative concerns of the Strip. And the second thing is that it's doing is actually similar to what it's doing with Hezbollah, or what it had done with Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is to reach an equilibrium, to reach a sort of an acceptable equation or balance of forces between Israel and Hamas, where there is almost agreement on the relationship between the two entities. For Israel, that agreement is calm for calm, which means there will be no Israeli attacks against the Gaza Strip as long as there's no rocket fire from Hamas. And for Hamas, the equation is always calm for lifting the blockade, that there will be no rocket fire from Gaza onto Israel if Israel loosens the access and entry into the Gaza Strip. Those equations, those two different starting points between Hamas and Israel, have been the function of the various wars and escalations between the two parties over the course of the past 14 years. Both parties are negotiating around calm and access, and around calm and restrictions on the blockade. That has been the equilibrium that has taken form and taken root in the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. In that equilibrium, Hamas has to be sustained as a functioning, very effective governing authority in the Gaza Strip, which for Israel justifies the blockade to an international community that might otherwise be skeptical. Now, the reason that this becomes, and again, just to reaffirm here, that the reason that this blockade is needed for Israel is for demographic reasons predominantly. And we can talk about historically what that blockade and the separation of Gaza looked like pre-Hamas. But the idea that this emerged as a result of Hamas's takeover of the Gaza Strip is historically inaccurate. But the reason May became such a turning point, as we said at the beginning, is because that equation, that equilibrium that has taken root between Hamas and Israel, Hamas fundamentally altered by saying, actually, the movement's use of force is not going to be limited to that negotiation. It's actually much more expansive than that. It's now focused on a negotiation that brings in a broader Palestinian narrative.
Thanks a lot for that as well. I wonder if that's okay, like two different points. It's also kind of continuation of your thought. A, you mentioned a lot the several restrictions of the blockade itself and how Hamas has always tried to alleviate some of that. So, I forgot what the numbers are, but, you know, a certain number of kilometers where fishermen are allowed to travel to fish, and then, you know, it's extended a tiny bit and then restricted and so on, like that kind of negotiation. Yeah, before I ask the second question, can you kind of just, in more details for those who don't know what we're talking about, A, what does the blockade actually restrict, in case people don't know that? And what gets negotiated, if you see what I mean?
So Israel controls Gaza's airspace, its maritime space, and its entry and exit points. People often refer to them as borders. They're not borders because there's no border between Israel and Gaza. This is a fence that separates 2 million Palestinians who are still under Israeli control from the rest of what is known as Israel-Palestine and places them in their own coastal enclave. That's the structure and the architecture of the blockade. In that kind of geographic separation, Israel controls, it controls everything, including the population registry and the documentation of newborns, let's say, in the Gaza Strip. In terms of access, it controls two things. It controls the entry and exit of all goods and people from the Gaza Strip. So the number of trucks that come in, what kind of material those trucks come in and out, so import and export, what kind of material those trucks are carrying. And it restricts the permits that individuals, whether they're tourists or individuals seeking healthcare or workers in Israel, how many individuals are allowed into the Gaza Strip and out of the Gaza Strip. But then it controls also geographic access. So we have the buffer zone, which is the area around this fence, which is an area that's important for agriculture in the Gaza Strip, which is controlled by Israeli forces, often snipers, that try to limit access to areas around the periphery of the Gaza Strip on the inside of the fence, as well as what you mentioned, which is the area that Palestinian fishermen are able to go fishing off of the coastal enclave, which varies all the way from 3 nautical miles to 12 nautical miles. So for the past 14 years, the escalations, the fire exchanges between Israel and Hamas have, for the most part, ended in ceasefire negotiations that would entail a list of demands that include things like expanding the access of fishermen around the coastal area up to 12, increasing the number of permits of Palestinian workers working in Israel to exit the Gaza Strip, increasing the and allowing for Palestinians seeking medical treatment, either in the West Bank or in Israel, to leave the Gaza Strip, and calling for the entry of more goods, whether for reconstruction or other goods. I mean, obviously, there's the other entry point into the Gaza Strip, which is the Rafah border with Egypt, and this is an actual border. And there is often significant variations in terms of the movement of goods and people there. Often that becomes a pressure point because the Egyptian authorities work with the Israeli authorities to try to limit the entry of goods and people and to try to increase pressure on Hamas, depending on the state of negotiations or the state of the local politics or whatever the case might be. But that's sort of the other pressure hold on the Gaza Strip. But it's essentially, it's always been a negotiation by Hamas to try to alleviate the economic and humanitarian suffering in the Gaza Strip. So often when, just before periods of escalation, there would be significant shortages of goods in Gaza, or the economy in Gaza would have taken a significant hit. And the effort by Hamas to try to alleviate that sometimes takes the form of the use of rocket fire to initiate negotiations.
Thanks a lot for that as well. It's really expensive explanations. The kind of the second part of that same question, you mentioned how, like, I mean, the title of your book, right, is Hamas Contained. And so a lot of my question rather is this, in your view, like a end in itself, like the Israeli policy of quote unquote containing Hamas is an end in itself? Or as you say, like, basically, I'm asking you to expand on that. This separation between that the Israelis have been trying to do between especially Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Can you sort of just explain that a bit more, if that's okay, for those who may have not caught your initial explanation?
Absolutely. So in terms of the containment, the policy is very much one of containment, that Hamas as a political party, an Islamist party, a nationalist party committed to Palestinian liberation through armed struggle. The policy is to contain that within the Gaza Strip, which means to try to limit the movement's capacity to maneuver and to function to a very small strip of land. And institutionally, where the movement was present in the West Bank through security coordination with the PAA, that infrastructure has been dismantled. So Hamas has effectively been contained. At the same time, and as I said a couple of questions ago, there is an effort by Israel to maintain Hamas as a governing authority and an effective governing authority in the Gaza Strip that is able to administer the needs of 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. That reality of having both a government that is seen by Israel and by the West as a terrorist organization that might justify the placement of the blockade, while at the same time allowing Israel to not worry about the humanitarian collapse in the Gaza Strip, because there is an administrative authority taking care of these needs of the Palestinians in Gaza, allows the blockade to appear sustainable. And in many ways it is. We're in the 14th year of the blockade, and there's no sign at all that either Israel or the international community are considering ways in which the blockade can be removed. And rather than considering those, that the removal of the blockade has now become tethered to the idea of a Hamas disarming, which, as I said, misunderstands the blockade by placing it as something that is a reaction to Hamas rather than the demographic reality in Palestine. So that's the sort of the overall structure. It's both a policy of containment and a policy of managing Hamas as a governing authority in the Gaza Strip, obviously outsourcing much of the cost to international payers, including the EU and Qatar. Now, when we stop thinking of Hamas as an exceptional movement, and we start looking sort of a zoom out of Israel-Palestine and look at it as a single state, which it is, because there's a single sovereign between the river and the sea, Hamas and the Gaza Strip stop being an exception. They actually become a representative of how Israel deals with Palestinians throughout the territory. So if we look at areas A throughout the occupied West Bank, we have also instances of Palestinian population centers that are entirely surrounded by Israel and Israeli-controlled territory that are governed by Palestinian governing institutions, whether they're the PA or otherwise. And even within Israel itself, we see the containment of Palestinians in heavily populated, very dense Palestinian urban centers surrounded by communities and cities that Palestinians might not be able or have as much freedom living in. So the Gaza Strip is just an extreme of a policy by Israel, which is a policy that began before 1948, which is to consolidate territory and dispossess Palestinians, to consolidate territory for Jewish settlements and to dispossess Palestinians. The outcome is the enclosure of Palestinians in smaller and smaller urban enclaves, and the management of these urban enclaves by Palestinian governing authorities, while the overarching control obviously rests in the hands of the Israeli state. So Hamas just takes on the veneer of something that's exceptional because of its Islamism and because of its commitment to armed struggle. But in terms of the overall structure of what we're dealing with, the Gaza Strip, in my mind, is just the natural endpoint of Israeli settler colonialism in Palestine.
It makes a lot of sense. Thanks a lot as well for reframing it in that way. And, you know, given this policy of containing, isolating Hamas in Gaza and Gaza, and also given that Hamas, quote unquote, broke out of its cage, you know, to kind of borrow from that title, how might or how did the recent protests throughout historic Palestine, so between the River and the Sea, modern Israel, and the occupied Palestinian territories, for those confused about the vocab, how might have that changed the dynamic, or did it change kind of that dynamic in your view?
It changed the dynamic, not necessarily just in the sense that Hamas was able to break out of its containment in Gaza. It changed that dynamic in ways that are more fundamental than that. So Hamas breaking out of its cage in the Gaza Strip, it changed a dynamic that is specific to Hamas, which is the one that I just articulated in terms of this relationship that had taken root between Hamas and Israel, this equilibrium of violence, I call it. That broke with the recent turn in May. And Hamas was able to position itself, despite the absence of elections, as actually the movement that is most popular on the Palestinian street, as an armed movement that is willing to protect Palestinians who are facing the brunt of a very violent occupation committed to their dispossession. So Hamas broke out of its containment in the figurative sense, in the symbolic sense, and was able to, and in the military sense very clearly, and was able to position itself as this movement speaking and reacting on behalf of Palestinians. But I think that the reason I say that the shift was more fundamental than that is because I think that what we saw was a breaking down of a psychological barrier that Palestinians have long suffered from for decades, that we often talk about when we say their fragmentation, that Palestinian citizens of Israel are a separate constituents than Palestinians in Jerusalem or the West Bank or Gaza. And the uprising and the mobilization, the unity intifada, was one that, you know, it's still unclear where it will go. It is still unclear if it will change fundamentally the equations on the ground. But it nonetheless had a transformative impact in the sense that psychologically, it reaffirmed Palestinian peoplehood as a single people. So it reaffirmed this sense that they are, no matter where they are, even in the diaspora, even as refugees, even if they have not faced the brunt of the Israeli occupation forces on their day-to-day, that they are a single people fighting a single regime. So the transformation was significant in that sense, that it affirmed Palestinian peoplehood, but also affirmed the notion that Palestinians, no matter where they are fighting the same regime. And in that transformation, Hamas is only one element. It is the Islamist element or the element and the element that is committed to armed struggle. But that is only one element in what is emerging as a diverse, heterogeneous Palestinian movement, which of course it always has been. And now we're seeing it manifest on the ground so that, you know, Palestinians protesting against PA repression and against the Sheikh Jarrah dispossession in the West Bank, for example, coexist alongside rocket fire from Gaza, alongside Palestinians protesting in 48. And so Hamas then, in that vision of unity, in that sort of singularity of the Palestinian movement that is a diverse movement, Hamas stops being exceptional. We then begin to understand Hamas as part and parcel, as only one thread of a much more complex tapestry of Palestinian mobilization. So I think in that, to say that there is a transformation that's fundamental specifically for Hamas in terms of breaking out of its cage, but the transformation on the level of Palestinians is actually much broader than that. And it's one that's inclusive in the sense that it brings Hamas in, despite what many people might disagree with its ideology or its tactics, into the Palestinian fold.
And is there any possibility at all of these recent developments or changes also affecting like the politics of the occupiers? At the electoral level, it hasn't. I mean, I guess it's too recent, I don't know. But can it? And even if it can, is that something worth looking at in your view?
The politics of the occupier, you mean domestic Israeli politics?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, I think domestic Israeli politics, I mean, there will always be variations in terms of the makeup of the government, you know, how right wing versus left wing it is. This latest government commentators are very interested in it because it includes an Islamist, it includes Meretz, the left wing party, and it includes far right parties. Of course, there will always be variations within, and the Israeli electorate might choose quote unquote more moderate governments as tensions continue within the Israeli domestic sphere around what to do with the Palestinians. But fundamentally and structurally, there can not, no Israeli government is going to significantly challenge the current reality in Israel-Palestine until the occupation and until Palestinian mobilization makes the occupation untenable. So until there's a fundamental shift in the balance of forces on the ground, which for that to happen, there needs to be a shift on the international stage in terms of allowing Israel to continue to operate with impunity. But until the balance of power fundamentally changes and forces a reckoning by the Israeli government, I personally think that it's a waste of time to think about the makings of the Israeli government. I mean, I don't want to overstate that because there are always openings that, of course, can be leveraged in order to shift public opinion within Israel. But the point that I'm trying to make is that fundamentally, the Israeli state now is a state that is committed to maintaining a system of apartheid. Constitutionally, it is a state that is committed to Jewish preferential citizenship over Palestinians, which some have citizenship, most are military subjects or refugees. So this regime, the Israeli government and its electoral politics are fundamentally a part of this regime of domination. So regardless of whether there are changes in the internal makings of it, it will be tinkering around this sort of monolithic structure in some ways until that structure begins to shift because of external and internal pressure by Palestinians and by members of the international community. It's very hard to see electoral politics changing fundamentally.
No, yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, the occupation is never actually part of any kind of debates, you know, between Israeli politicians, at least not at the national stage. So my next question is, I mean, I just can't not ask it. You know, just a few days ago, Nizal Banat was murdered, and the ongoing repression by a number of journalists and activists and others in the West Bank by the PA. Given that there is this more of a grassroots reception of Hamas, right? Like on the streets, and given in this sharp contrast with how the PA is acting towards Palestinians and being seen by many as, you know, collaborators or essentially the enforcers of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, and given this ongoing, like at the time of recording, this is still happening as well. A repression happened like yesterday or 2 days ago as well. How is this likely to develop, if at all, in terms of how people view the PA?
The PA has lost legitimacy among the Palestinian public. Has been losing legitimacy consistently for years. And I think this current moment in time, which has shown a significant mobilization by Palestinians in the West Bank against the PA security coordination and its repressive use of force against Palestinians, culminating in the murder of Nizar Banat, is something that is just the apex, the climax in some ways, of increasing resentment and increasing frustration against the PA and what the PA is, which is a fundamental part of the Israeli occupation. There is, just as we were talking about Hamas being a governing authority that Israel depends on to administer state of affairs in Gaza, the PA is a crucial cog in the Israeli occupation. It is how the Palestinian affairs in the West Bank are managed. And security coordination is fundamental to the sustainability of the occupation, unlike Hamas, which remains ideologically committed to armed resistance and to fighting for liberation. The PA has acquiesced to its role as a subcontractor to the occupation. And security coordination is reviled by Palestinians. So what we see at the moment is really the manifestation of that repulsion and the very clear, undeniable reality that the PA is now, is like Israel, committed to managing the status quo rather than moving the Palestinian cause further. Now, it's not actually the PA's job to move the Palestinian cause further. That's the PLO's job. But under Mahmoud Abbas, the PLO has been subsumed into the PA, and the PA itself has become more authoritarian, more draconian in its policies. And an entity that is, even though putting forward the performances of statehood, is really an entity that is quite content at playing this performance or remaining committed to this notion of statehood without actually seeking liberation. Now, the question of, is this a turning point? Is the PA likely to disintegrate or collapse or deal with this repression? It remains unclear. I think the PA is quite sustainable for various reasons, including the fact that it employs hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. And the PA is obviously an entity that Israel and the international community are very committed to upkeeping because, as we said, there is rather than an interest to allowing for Palestinians to capture their rights, there is a willingness to sustain the status quo. So there's a lot of capacity for the PA to survive this current mobilization against it. At the same time, I really do not see any prospect for the PA to revitalize its image among Palestinians. I think its image has been getting tarnished for years, but this moment is quite drastic. The one other thing I would say here is that this represents also a moment of catastrophe for Fatah. Itself has been, as a movement, has been divided increasingly between the people who support the PA, so Fatah, the Fatah that has been in some ways part and parcel of the PA, and the Fatah that is more committed to the revolutionary roots of the movement. Those divisions are likely to get more and more exacerbated as there's more resentment by Fatah leaders for being implicated in what the PA has become. We're more likely to see tensions within Fatah itself.
Yeah, it makes sense as well. The final question is just going to be about like this idea that you and others have had about resuscitating the PLO. But before asking that, we mentioned the authoritarianism of the PA, and of course I'll reference the conversation I had with Daniel Kurd because we got into that even more than we have the time to do so here. But what about, has there been discussions within the Hamas leadership, within even Hamas, rank and file members, about Hamas's authoritarianism within the Gaza Strip? So I'm not talking about its attitude towards the Israeli state or anything like that. I'm talking like how journalists are able to do their jobs. Yes, so, that kind of domestic quote unquote policies. And I'm using this in quotations.
Absolutely. I mean, I think like the PA, Hamas is also an authoritarian governing authority. They are incapable of allowing for political plurality to emerge in the Gaza Strip, in for example, by allowing Fatah to mobilize in the Gaza Strip is quite difficult. It's not impossible, and we've seen instances of Fatah mobilizing, but it's quite difficult. There are restrictions on freedom of speech. There are human rights abuses in terms of detaining Palestinians who protest Hamas rule. There are examples of extrajudicial killings within Hamas's prisons. So the movement should in no way be let off the hook in terms of its authoritarianism as a governing authority in the Gaza Strip. And those have all been documented by human rights organizations, local, including Al Mizan and others, and international, including Amnesty and HRW. So both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip now are administered and governed by Palestinian authorities under an Israeli occupation that themselves have become quite authoritarian and quite brutal. The way that Hamas leaders talk about this is often to say two things. The first is that they are an Islamist movement. So they are a movement that is committed to socializing Islamic values in society. And that often comes with some degree of policing around social behavior and around norms. And so they justify their behavior ideologically by saying that this is how one can nurture a virtuous Islamic society. And the second is obviously by blaming the occupation, that often there needs to be a fist, an iron fist from the top down to manage the kind of resistance that's coming out of the Gaza Strip. And by resistance, I'm using that in the expansive sense, not just military resistance, but also economic and social resistance, to allow for Palestinian Sumud and to nurture this idea of Gaza becoming the forefront of the resistance against the occupation. And by doing that, obviously deflecting from their own authoritarianism and shifting the gaze back onto the occupation. And there have been protests within Gaza against Hamas's rule, which have been met with force as well.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that as well. You know, the next question was going to be about the whole resuscitating PLO, but is there something about our, you know, broader conversation about Hamas and the context in which we're discussing it that you wanted to kind of expand upon more, or, you know, I could have asked a bit differently?
I just want to say that, you know, when we're thinking about Hamas, it's really important for people to sort of separate the movement from the government. And right. the two exist, right? Hamas is a movement that is existing in the Palestinian territories, but also in Turkey, in Qatar, in Egypt. That's not to say that it's a transnational movement. It is in the sense that its leadership is everywhere and its membership is everywhere, but it's not transnational in the sense that wherever it is as a movement, it is committed to the idea of liberation in Palestine itself. And in that sense, it's a very nationalist movement. But that movement coexists alongside the government, which is the bureaucracy that exists in the Gaza Strip and that administers Gaza. So when we're thinking of Hamas, it's important to hold both of these in our minds, because obviously we're you know, in talking about authoritarianism now, we're talking about the government in the Gaza Strip. That's not necessarily us talking about the movement, and the ideology is shared, and while the movement sets the strategy, the government implements it. So that's not to let the movement off the hook, but just to understand that there are different power plays and dynamics in terms of the movement itself. But the reason why I'm bringing this idea of the movement is because while we're talking about democracy and elections, I think it's important to note that Hamas is a very democratic movement, that unlike other movements, certainly unlike Fatah, has seen a significant change in terms of its leadership, in terms of the power shifts within the movement between different constituencies. The Shura Council is very active in terms of setting the movement's strategy. And so in that sense, the movement is actually quite a democratic movement.
Thanks a lot for that talk as well. So kind of to end on a different note in some ways before going to the book section of our episode, I know you've been involved in a number of like initiatives, and it's a project on, I believe, on the Shabaka, among others, but feel free to correct me, on this idea of resuscitating the PLO. Daniel could also mention this in our conversation. So what does that look like for you, and like how can you explain it, how would you explain it?
I think the thing to note is actually to separate this question of Palestinian representation from the PLO. I think the thing to note is that Palestinians need a representative body and a representative leadership that speaks to the Palestinian people. As we just talked about, there's a sense of peoplehood mm-hmm. that's now re-emerging. It's always been there, but that's now at the surface. And there needs to be a Palestinian body that is able to speak to and on behalf of Palestinians, no matter where they are. Now, that body historically was the PLO, but at this moment in time, I think Palestinians have a strategic question that they need to answer, which is, should the PLO be reformed in order to take the current institutionally defunct, unrepresentative body that we are now left with after years of Oslo and Mahmoud Abbas's rule? Is that reformable, and should that be resuscitated? Or is it time to move into a post-PLO reality and think of other ways in which representation and legitimacy can be nurtured? That question is a strategic question, and it's one that is very difficult to answer because it's not just an institutional issue. The PLO holds the diplomatic and the legal character for Palestinians on the international stage, including at the UN. Letting go of the PLO lets go of a lot of the victories that Palestinians have accumulated over their past. Those victories might no longer be relevant in the sense that many of the UN resolutions talk about the two-state solution and partition, and we might have already moved into a reality where the notion of partition is no longer possible, and we need to think of other paradigms in which to understand Israel-Palestine most importantly, a framework of decolonization and the apartheid framework to understand Israel-Palestine. But all of those have implications in terms of the legal character of the whatever Palestinian representative there might be on the international stage. So the issue of the PLO for me is a secondary issue. The more important issue is to think about how best to create institutions that are able to speak to and in behalf of Palestinians globally, and from there to think about what kind of institution can achieve that goal.
My final question is one I ask for, you know, all of my guests, which is like, do you have three books to recommend for our listeners?
Absolutely. So I think that Sarah Roy's book, Hamas and Civil Society in Gaza, is fundamental for our understanding of Hamas, of the Gaza Strip, and of the complexities that we were talking about. So that's one. One of the key books on Hamas in terms of its ideology, certainly in its earlier years, is Khaled Haroub's book on Hamas. I believe it's called Hamas. And that was one of the first books that came out of Hamas, and it gives a lot of insight into the movement's founding. And a very interesting book that I'm just reading now, which is fundamental for our understanding of Hamas at this moment in time, as we're talking about apartheid and decolonization, is called Decolonizing Palestine by Sandeep Sen. And it's, despite the title, focused specifically on Hamas. And I think it's a very powerful portrayal of Hamas in a decolonization framework.
Thanks a lot for that as well. So the book that you mentioned is called Hamas, A Beginner's Guide. I looked it up while you were talking. All right. Well, Tari, thank you a lot for your time. This has really been like expansive and everything, and I'm sure listeners would agree. And yeah, thanks a lot for chatting with me.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me and for reaching out.